This is the No Dumber Podcast. I'm Brian Hogan, and this evening I'm joined by Scott Helm, security researcher based in the UK, but he's joining me from Toronto this evening. Scott, thank you very much for taking time out of your evening.
No problem. How's it going?
Very well. To start off, can you tell me a little bit about yourself, please, Scott?
So, as you introduced me, security researcher, I've been in the security field for quite a while now. Originally, just as a hobbyist kind of sideline hacker security researcher. Moved into security formally as a penetration tester. I've been a security consultant as well. And then a few years ago, I founded my own little sideline project that grew into a startup, a full business, which we took investment in just over a year ago. So I'm currently running that at Report URI. I also run securityheaders.com, which is like a free online scanner tool for HTTP security headers that quite a few people use now. And I blog and speak at conferences as well. So I have quite the variety of things that I do.
Do you have one particular favorite, the blogging, the conferencing, the training, the whatever it happens to be?
Ooh, that's a tough one. They're all kind of complementary in a way because the training kind of pays the bills. The conferencing is generally not a profitable, like a non-profit thing. Same for blogging and my sideline projects as well. So I think it would be hard to pick one because I couldn't kind of do one without the other, if that makes sense. You know, like I do the training to pay the bills, and that gives me the time to go to conferences and speak publicly, which I do because I enjoy. So, yeah, I think they all play their own part.
Tonight, we're going to get on to two particular things, sub-resource integrity and content security policy. But before we get on to those, we need a little bit of background, and I think maybe asking you about cross-site scripting would be a good start. So for people who haven't heard of it, what is cross-site scripting?
So cross-site scripting is a kind of a generic term that essentially covers when someone gets script into your website that shouldn't be there. So if you imagine that, you know, we have like the Bank of Brian and you have your login page and there's, you know, a couple of bits of script and styles and things on there. If an attacker was able to get script onto that page that shouldn't be there, then that script could do really bad things like log keystrokes or pull down other malicious scripts that include in the page. It could redirect the user to a fake login form, change the login form. It essentially can do anything. So cross-site scripting is essentially when we end up with hostile script in our page. And there's many different ways that that can happen. So we have things like persistent XSS, reflected XSS, DOM XSS. So there's different types of cross-site scripting, but they all kind of, you know, form around that central concept of there is some script in my page that should not be here.
Is that limited to JavaScript or are there other types of script?
No, yeah. So XSS is essentially JavaScript. It's hostile JS that's doing things that's there that shouldn't be, and it's doing things that we don't want.
Can you give a few examples of some maybe sites you've come across or some famous instances of cross-site scripting?
Wow, there's been loads of demos of XSS across the years. There was a really good one. It's going back quite a few years now, and I may be pronouncing the gentleman's name wrong, but I think it was Brenno de Winter, who's a Dutch journalist, and he found several cross-site scripting attacks in different Dutch banks and demonstrated nothing too hostile, but he injected like music and animations into the bank's pages so that when you went to them, they played that horrible song, the Harlem Shake. I don't know if you may have heard of it, but you would load the page and it would play the Harlem Shake and images would bounce around and go crazy. So that was like a fairly notable one. There's been countless examples of it across the years, and some of them are super trivial as well. You know, they're so easy to carry out. I guess that's kind of the worry.
How would you carry it out? So let's, you know, take the example of that bank, for example. Speaking naively, I would say I need access to the server. I need to put some files on it in order for them to execute. But of course, this is cross-site. So how do I get something that's not on that site to execute on that page?
So most of the ones that I saw with the bank ones, if we look at those specifically, was if you imagine you have like a search function on the website and you go and type in application form and hit the search button, it will take you to the search results page and it will say like, here are your search results for application form, which is the string that you typed in the search box. So we call that a reflected piece of content. You typed it into the search box, and then the server gave you a page back with the string in the page. So then, if we kind of go back to the start of that process, if you put a script tag in the search box and you hit search, the server will give you the results page back with your script tag written into it. So you've then made the bank's page have a script tag in it that shouldn't be there. We call that a reflected cross-site scripting attack. And at that point, the script tag is in the page, and off we go. You can put whatever script you want in there.
I see, and it can be arbitrarily large or small.
Yeah, so you could write the script tag with the script in line, so like an actual script tag with the JavaScript in there, or you could do a script tag with a source attribute and say just load this script over on this other domain, so that you could do either one of those, which means yes, you could have basically as much JavaScript as you would like.
As I was preparing for this podcast, I came across a blog post by Troy Hunt where he was talking about some sites where a script was altered in order to turn the web browsers on that connecting to that site into crypto mining bots effectively. Is that pretty common these days?
Yeah, so we saw, I think we've kind of seen the rise and fall of that in a very short amount of time. So I actually did a story, I think, gosh, let me just check on this actually. So I did a really big piece in the UK about this, and it was all over government websites in the UK. So like actual .gov.uk sites were running these like crypto miners. We used to call it crypto jacking. And essentially, this is a super easy way for an attacker to take a cross-site scripting attack where they found a way to get some script in a page or some other mechanism of getting script in a page. And it's like, okay, we can make the page do funny things, or we can load files, or if you steal a user's credentials, you still then, as an attacker, as a person that's a criminal, you still have to find a way to monetize that. It's like, okay, I've got your username and password, but I don't have any money yet. I have to go do more things. So with the crypto jacking, it's like, hey, if we just take over your PC and start mining cryptocurrency, we literally get the cryptocurrency deposited in our wallet. So it's like instant monetization. So I just pulled up that story here. It was February last year. So it was literally a year ago, actually. It's 5 days off 1 year ago. And it hit all kinds of government sites in the UK, some in the US, and some in Australia as well. So that was a pretty big one. But we've already kind of seen a decline in that happening.
And what was it? Was the weakness that a script that was being used by multiple sites served over a content delivery network had been compromised?
Yes, that was. I can't, oh, what was it? It was a text-to-speech plugin. So it was like,
Oh, for
if
accessibility, wasn't it?
yes, that's the word I was looking for. So if someone was hard of sight and they couldn't, read the screen, they had like an audio icon and you could click it and it would read the text on the page. Unfortunately, that plugin, that feature was compromised to do text-to-speech and mine cryptocurrency at the same time.
It's an impressive way of doing things. Before we get on to CSP and SRI, what have been the traditional ways of combating cross-site scripting?
So we still have the kind of the two main traditional mechanisms, really, which we would still advise people to use today. They take the form of input validation and output encoding. So input validation would be, to go back to the search box example earlier, if I want to try and put a script tag in the search box, I'm going to need to put an angle bracket in there. So you might say, on this input field, we're going to validate the input from the user. And we're going to ban angle brackets because if you're putting angle brackets in there, maybe you're doing something bad, like using a script tag. So that would be input validation. I'm not input validation, obviously, because it's I don't like input validation. I much prefer output encoding because it's a much more reliable mechanism. So, output encoding. So output encoding would be when we're rendering that page back to the browser and we're rendering a string that the user gave us into the HTML context, you have to HTML encode the string. So instead of rendering the angle brackets, you'd have like ampersand LT and ampersand GT instead, which means when that hits the browser, it won't be an actual script tag. And that's a much more reliable mechanism.
Why do you say it's more reliable?
The problem with kind of input validation and things like that is that you need to know every like possible quirky combination and things that people might do. So, you know, people might say, okay, you can't have open angle bracket script in lowercase, close angle bracket. And then someone might capitalize it or capitalize just the C or the R. And, you know, so with the input stuff, you're really getting more and more and more complex because you need to constantly be aware of the things that you're blacklisting. Whereas with output encoding, it's like, hey, look, we've got this string and we're going to render it into HTML. If we just HTML encode it, it doesn't matter what's in there. It doesn't matter if we miss something. It doesn't matter if it is a script tag, because once we HTML encode it, it's not a script tag. So if you were going to do one of the two, it would always be output encoding. However, you can do both of them if you wish.
Yeah, as well, I think another advantage probably is if you're getting, you could have multiple ways of getting information into your system. So a person could type it in, it could be coming in through an API, it could be coming in through a file load or a database job. So now you have to protect all of those ways of doing it too. Whereas again, as you say, with the output, you're doing it all in one spot, I hope, or you'd hope.
Absolutely, yeah. And the other thing as well is kind of like touching on your, you don't know where it's coming in, maybe where it's going out in the future will be different. You know, so if you've, another really good example for cross-site scripting is like a comment or review system. Hey, leave a 5-star review on our homepage with a comment, and the comment has the script tag in. So that, you know, the comment and the review must be stored in a database. We pull them out and dump them into the page. What if you want to pull the comments via an API at some point in the future and you're not rendering the comment into a HTML context but a JSON context? Then the encoding would be different. Now, if you try to do the filtering on the way in, the filtering on the way in for HTML will look very different to the filtering on the way in for JSON. So again, it's much more preferred to do this on the way out when you know where you're rendering the string into.
Yeah, I remember, that, not to, to beat a dead donkey, but I remember with SQL injection as well, I worked with a guy and he'd come up with his own scrubber, and of course it wasn't particularly good. But then as I was reading more about it, I came across something where you could put in a Unicode number for a semicolon or whatever it was, as opposed to putting in the semicolon, and then that became a flaw depending on how it was read on the far side. And yeah, you know, as you say, it became, with SQL injection, obviously you do need input value, you do need to protect on the input, but home making your validation is very tough around those things. So if you're using, let's say, as a lot of the audience is, .NET, are there good libraries for the output and the input validation?
So I'm a PHP dev, so I really don't know on the .NET side, but okay. I guess the answer to this, and this kind of ties into a much bigger thing that we're seeing recently, is the frameworks are getting a lot better at this. And this is something that I'm really happy about and really sad about at the same time, because we're seeing a big decline in XSS. We've seen it drop in the OWASP rankings. It used to be like, gosh, I think it was like number one or number two or something, and now it's number seven. So it's kind of fallen all the way down the rankings. And it's like, yes, you know, we must be getting better at this. We're finally fixing the problem. And we kind of are, but it's the framework saving us from ourselves. So I don't know if I'm happy that XSS is reducing, but unhappy about the fact that it's not because we're getting better as people. It's just that a couple of frameworks are getting better and saving us. So I don't know. It's good. And yes, your framework, you know, if you're using a security conscious framework, you should be able to have fairly good reliance on that.
All right, I'm going to move us on a little bit from the traditional ways. And there is something newer, and it's called content security policy. Can you explain that one, please, Scott?
Yeah, so CSP is something that I'm I'm really involved in at the moment. I've been following and involved in for a long time because it's really simple and really powerful at the same time. So one of the biggest problems with cross-site scripting attacks is that someone will drop that script tag in your page, like we mentioned before with the comment field or the search field. And often what they do is they'll load a third-party script file from another domain. So they'll just be like, hey, I've got the script tag in, go load evil.com/keylogger.js, right? And the browser will just load that file in and execute it. With content security policy, when you serve your page to the browser, you can also send it a list of all of the locations that you expect the page to load content from. Here's my web page. On this page, I'm going to load images from these two domains. I'm going to load style sheets from these three domains, and I'm going to load scripts from these three domains. So you actually provide the browser a little list that says, this is exactly everything that I expect to happen. And the browser will enforce that for you. And what that means is, you know, going to the script example, because this is the real powerful part of CSP. If we see script being loaded from a domain that it should not be loaded from, the browser will refuse to load it. So we can prevent that hostile third-party script from being loaded and executed.
But I need to know all of my domains, don't I, for this to work? I would have to be aware of, if I've got, you know, web analytics, I've got some image thing, I've got some social media sharing, I need to whitelist all those?
Yeah, so it does require you to have that level of knowledge. Like, you know, what are, if we're going to list all of our third-party sources of content, then of course we're going to have to build that list. But and I appreciate this is really difficult, especially for large or legacy applications as well, because there's potentially a lot of third-party content being loaded. But I think in many ways, this also demonstrates a bit of a problem, because I go to some organizations and they're like, do you know how many locations we load third-party content from? And we don't know, you know, where all of these things are, and we're going to have to build this list. And I'm like, well, this kind of touches on the problem a little bit for me. I was like, so you acknowledge that you load content from third parties, but you actually don't know who or where. And I'm like, that kind of just hints a little bit at the problem for me. I'm like, so you actually don't know exactly what's going on your website. There could be things being loaded that you don't know about or haven't audited or aren't documented. And you know, I think this forms part of the greater CSP proposition in that you must know what's going on your website. What third-party sources do we have? Which ones should we have?
It does make management very difficult, I imagine, because would it be reasonable that you might have a third party, you're pointing to a particular file, let's say a JavaScript file, and then the third party says, you know what, I'm going to do a redirect to somewhere else because I'm switching CDNs on you. And now all of a sudden your CSP will break. Does that happen with JavaScript first?
I mean, I've never come across that instance, and I do work pretty extensively with that. But I think, in many ways, again, it kind of comes back to the original point, right? Like, let's imagine I load this JavaScript from this third party, and I trust them to load this script, and I will put this script in my page, and you know, I trust them not to do bad things. But then one day they suddenly try to start sending me somewhere else for my JavaScript. And that's kind of indicative of the problem again, right? Like, would you just want that to happen? Would you suddenly just want your website to start going elsewhere and loading JavaScript from someone you don't know? So, and this is kind of where I end up really torn, in that I can see that there is a legitimate case where you may want that to happen, but also at the same time, you kind of really don't want that to happen, because the risk there is quite significant, right? Like, let's assume that it was a hostile takeover and the redirect was hostile. Would you want the browser to just, like, happy, happy, go pull down some random third-party JavaScript and run that instead? So, again, I see both sides of the argument here, and it's a difficult balancing act to get right.
But I imagine many people rely on downloading whatever the new cool JavaScript framework is from the likes of a Google CDN. I remember when I was playing with jQuery, you know, we didn't store the jQuery.js or whatever it was locally. We would use their one. Now, we were trusting them, but is that something you would advocate for, or would you say, you know what, take it down, keep the version of it, and then as they release new ones, get the new one and store it locally? Or would you still say, you know what, use their CDNs because it has a lot of advantages?
So I think there's probably like two different points that I'd like to split that out into. The number one is that I do use a CDN across my projects because I recognize the value proposition that they bring. So if we, you know, I use jQuery on one of my very high traffic websites, the jQuery file, the library is quite sizable. So by using a CDN provider, I'm saving myself a significant amount of bandwidth. If I'm loading that file from a large CDN provider, there's like a really good chance that the client might already actually have the same file in local cache, in which case none of us are loading it and we're all going a lot faster. So there are benefits of using a CDN that I recognize. I would never do something like loading, you know, /latest.jquery.min.js. I would always say you should probably version the path and load specific versions and never let them, you know, just like load whatever the latest version of the file is. I think that's another proposition that has some risks with it as well. But I see the value proposition of using a CDN, and I do use a CDN myself.
If I want to, let's say, use content security policy on my website, how do I do it now?
Originally, this was quite hard to do because CSP is just a HTTP response header. So when I said you send that list to the browser, you send the list in the response header. That's where the browser gets the information from. And essentially, you just need to start writing the list. So, you know, maybe you go through your code base and say, right, you know, grep for all script tags and let's look at the source attributes and then write down a list of all the source attributes. So originally, I felt this was a bit too clunky, which is why on one of the projects that I run on Report URI, we have this thing called the CSP Wizard. Now, we, with the CSP Wizard, can build your policy for you. So CSP also has this cool reporting mechanism where if something happens on your website that shouldn't have, like you're loading a script that shouldn't be there, it can also send a report back to you or a reporting service like us. So you deploy a policy onto your website that says, basically, there should be no content on my website, which means the browser will report to us all of the content on your site. And what that means is that we get to see the entire superset of content across all of your pages. So we know exactly where you load scripts from, and we can give you a list and say, these are the locations that you load scripts from. The same for styles, for images, for everything else. So historically, whilst this was a fairly manual and somewhat arduous task, with the wizard, we've made that a lot easier, and we're continuing to try to make that easier as well.
So then it sounds like this will work at the browser level. So it's dependent on the browser version. Do all browsers support this?
So yeah, this is happening in the browser, you're correct. The support for CSP is really, really good. I use a website called caniuse.com, which, you know, if you ever have a question about browser support for a particular thing, I always kind of kick back to that because it's really nice. CSP is supported in every mainstream browser right now, so that's a really good level of support to have. The other kind of interesting thing with this is even if we didn't have really good support, it almost wouldn't matter in a way, because let's say that only Firefox had support. If you have all the information coming from Firefox, then you have all the information. So you kind of don't need it to come from anywhere else. So I think this is one of those really nice features where, you know, even if we did have lower support than we do, it would kind of still be useful, actually.
I see. Yeah. Do you see any future changes to content security policy, or is it done? Is it a finished project?
So we do have another change in the spec coming soon, actually. Version 1 came out quite a few years ago now. I think, gosh, like maybe 2012 or something. Version 2 followed not too long after that, a couple of years after that. And version 3 is actually approaching standardization right now. We might actually see that in 2019 if everything goes well. So there are some more changes coming. There are some new features and new improvements as well. You know, every iteration of the spec, of course, we look back at things that we could have done better last time around and learn from those and improve them. So yeah, hopefully this year that should be landing.
All right, I'm going to move us on to the other thing we're going to talk about for tonight, and that's sub-resource integrity. So that's one word, sub-resource. What is sub-resource integrity?
So sub-resource integrity is, it kind of ties in with the concept of loading third-party content, which we were just talking about. So imagine you're loading that jQuery file from the Google CDN, and you know, you have your script tag with your source attribute, and it's like, you know, googlecdn.com/jQuery/3.1/jQuery.min.js. That's a very specific file on a very specific path. You can whitelist the Google CDN with content security policy, so script can only come from the Google CDN. But if the file on the Google CDN is changed, your browser would never know. You know, you're instructing the browser with the script tag, go to this domain, to this path, and get this file. But the browser has no idea what's in the file. So if you connect to the Google CDN one day, and instead of jQuery 3.1, you get a big piece of malware and a keylogger in the JavaScript, the browser's not going to know. And the browser will just pull down that malware and run it because that's what you told it to do. SRI allows you to test and detect if that has happened. So inside a script tag now, SRI allows you to add a new integrity attribute to the script tag. And inside that attribute, you put the hash of the file that you're expecting to get back. So you as the developer would get the jQuery 3.1 file and you would hash it and say, right, this is the hash of the file. We'll put that in the script tag. Now, when the browser downloads jQuery 3.1 from the CDN, it will hash the file that it got from the CDN and compare it to the hash in the script tag. If those two hashes match, then the browser can say, yep, we got the file that we were expecting. If those hashes don't match, then the browser can say, this file has been tampered with. Someone has made changes to this file. It's not the one we want. I'm going to throw that away.
Do you advocate for me as a developer of a website to make the hash of the jQuery file, or should I go to somewhere like the wherever Google store it and trust their hash?
So in a way, if you're going to the Google CDN, and I use the Cloudflare CDN, and we've also pushed other CDN providers like Max CDN and the actual jQuery CDN itself to do this, those websites now, if you go to copy like the latest jQuery script tag from the, you know, the CDN's website, that will include the SRI hash. Now, theoretically, I guess you could make the argument that if you were going to pull down that file and generate the hash yourself and not trust the one on their front page or their, you know, their documentation, you realistically, you probably would have to audit the file. Because if you just pull it down yourself and hash it yourself and trust that hash, then I don't think that we're in any better a position. So I'm fairly comfortable going to the CDN provider's website and copying their example script tag that includes the hash itself. Because outside of that, I feel like I would actually need to audit the code in order to be in any better position.
And actually, that does raise an interesting question. We do trust these third parties. Is there anyone who audits these things, or are we always handing over our trust to them for the likes of these big scripts that we rely on?
I imagine that, you know, that someone somewhere is doing like a very traditional, what you might refer to as an audit. I think more generally what I'm comfortable with is that if I'm using a very popular version of a library like jQuery 3.1, then it's constantly scrutinized. You know, we constantly see jQuery as an example and other frameworks fixing bugs in them because people are out there testing them, finding them. So, you know, whilst I'm not entirely sure if someone has sat down and actually done like a, you know, a paid for code audit, I know that these things are exposed, they are scrutinized, they are tested, and I'm somewhat happy with the exposure there and my needs. Some, you know, big company, large bank, multinational with billions of dollars may say, you know what, like we're going to get this code audited, and that's, you know, fantastic if they can do that. For me and where I am, I'm happy with the exposure that they get more broadly and more publicly.
Can I pick and choose which scripts I'm going to check the integrity of, or is it going to be for everything on my page that I now need to use it?
So that's up to you. If you're just using SRI, then you can include the attribute on any script tags that you want to have SRI checking take place on. You can also do this on styles as well, by the way. It's just that I usually focus on scripts because that's the powerful third-party resource. So, you know, if you have 20 script tags, you can put the SRI integrity attribute in 10 of them and not in the other 10. That's absolutely fine. However, if you want to have a more, if you want to not have the possibility to forget a script tag for SRI, then we go back to content security policy from earlier. And there's a feature in CSP that says require SRI for all scripts and styles on the page. So, you know, if your intention is to have SRI and everything, and you want to make sure that you don't omit or miss something by accident, then you can turn on this other feature and then you can't forget because you will be made to have SRI on everything.
What does it look like then if, let's say, I've put my hash in and I request the JavaScript and it doesn't match? What happens on the page?
It really depends on what the script did. So if the hash doesn't match, the script won't be loaded. So that's the hard failure of SRI. What that then looks like, it kind of comes back to what the script does. If the script doesn't really do anything, or maybe it's just your analytics script, then I guess we're not going to see any, you know, visual or functional impact. If, however, it is the jQuery 3.1 file and that doesn't load, then, you know, I imagine your website's going to be a bit of a disaster at that point in time. So it really depends on what the script does that you're loading as to what impact it has if it doesn't load.
Yeah, so pretty much like me, when I'm using Firefox, I use NoScript. So when I go to a new website, I'm clicking through one by one, allowing some scripts and not allowing others. And the site can look terrible until I figure out the right combination.
Essentially,
is that
something?
sorry, go ahead.
No, I was going to say essentially that's kind of where you are. You know, if you block the scripts because they're being tampered with, or if you block them because of NoScript, then that's what it would look like, just obviously with a different root cause.
I had a friend of mine tell me that I'm a bit of a dinosaur for using NoScript. Do you see many people out there using it still?
I've not, you know, and I kind of looked at this like many when I had like a slightly more absolutist security person's view on things. But then I started to value convenience a tad more as well. So that became somewhat difficult with so many sites that just kind of really don't work without script. And that's not a, you know, a criticism. I think that's just the world that we're moving towards. But I also run an ad blocker right now as well. And with some of the recent things I've done on my network, I installed like a DNS filter on my network. I'm tempted to get rid of the ad blocker as well, because we've seen browser extensions go rogue. We've seen browser extensions do things that, you know, they have a great level of power. Essentially, they have all the power. And I guess I'm becoming more uncomfortable with having a browser extension than I am with the risks that it fixes. So that's probably more part of the general me leaning away from them.
Interesting. I know a lot of VPNs as well provide very similar features to the ad blockers, in that they'll filter a very wide variety of ads for you without the risk of compromising your browser, of course.
Yeah, and this is, you know, we're seeing, it's really interesting that we're seeing such a drive to that in the wider industry right now. The thing that I was just mentioning is called a Pi hole that I installed on my network. So it's a Raspberry Pi with a, you know, a DNS resolver and a blacklist in there. And I just use that for my local DNS server, and it just kills known hostile domains.
Can you see any drawbacks to using either CSP or SRI?
There's no drawbacks to the mechanisms themselves. Like they offer protections. I can see drawbacks in for large or legacy applications. CSP can be difficult to gain that visibility into all of your external content sources. You know, if you deploy them wrong, or you deploy them misconfigured, then that could cause some, you know, temporary breakage in your site. So there's to kind of like, my answer would be there are no drawbacks to using CSP or SRI, you know, like in and of themselves. There could be like a couple of hiccups along the way, but they're nothing kind of to do with the mechanism, more the implementation side. So I only see benefits to using either or both of these two things.
People want to catch up with you, Scott. Have you got any more conferences coming up in the next few months?
You know, I've just finished a couple actually. So I was in I was at NDC in London last week, and NDC Security in Oslo the week prior to that. And I think, you know, I think my next conference could be June now. So I've tried to dial back a little bit this year. I went a bit mad last year on the conference and travel circuit. So I think IP Expo in Manchester actually, for anyone based over in the sunny UK near me. Let me just see when that is.
Yeah. So you said Oslo in June. That's, I presume, NDC Oslo.
Yes, that's correct. Yeah, the big one. It's always a brilliant conference, so I always make sure I can do that. Yeah. So IP Expo in Manchester is in April. Okay. So yeah, I can be caught at those events.
And then you said you do some training. Is that are they public training classes people can sign up for, or are they more private and corporate?
Do you know, originally the intention was that they'd be public. Like the plan was I'd, you know, maybe run one a quarter and people could come. But what I've seen is there's been a huge uptake in the private space. A company might send one or two people to a public one to kind of test it out, but then say, right, we need, you know, five batches of this training internally. And that eats up all of my time for a couple of months. So I spend most of my time doing private training, but that was never kind of that was never the intention. It's just how things worked out.
So as of now, no classes that anyone can sign up to in a given city?
No, I think not in the immediate future. I've got NDC Security, which is the Gold Coast version over in Australia. That's in April, and I will be doing a public workshop there, but that's literally on the 29th and 30th of April. So that's a couple months out. And then obviously NDC Oslo, which we just mentioned, I'll also be doing a training workshop there as well.
Oh, that sounds very good. Any final notes before we wrap up for the evening, Scott?
No, just I'm going to keep plugging away and doing my thing. Back over to the UK this weekend for visit the family. I've been away for a few weeks now. It's kind of weird coming to you from snowy, rainy, minus 18 degrees Canada.
I'll put the show notes, I'll put links into your sites on the show notes, but if people don't check them, where would they go to find you?
The best place is probably scotthelm.co.uk, which is my blog. So that links out to my other projects, the things that I've mentioned. I have training and public speaking agendas on there as well. So that's like the central repository for all information, Scott.
Scott Helm, thank you very much for your time this evening.
Cheers, Ryan.
If you like this episode, you might also like episode 107 with Niall Murrigan, where we talk about hacking, bug bounties, and responsible disclosure, or episode 88 with Aaron Bedra, where we look at threat modeling. The opening music was Return by Nisi 23 from the album 11 and 12, and the closing music was I'm Not Here instrumental by Junior 85 from the album Imposter Syndrome.